Welcome, everybody, to the Across the Sky podcast, our Lee Enterprises weather podcast. We are 77 markets all across the country, and we are talking all about the winter ahead. And whether you love snow or you hate snow, there's one guy who knows a lot about snow, and he's joining us today. That is Judah Cohen. He is the director of seasonal forecasting for AER in Massachusetts. We will get to him in a little bit. But first, let me turn it over to my Lee Weather family. We'll start off with Kirsten over in Tulsa. Kirsten, how do we feel about snow? How do people in Tulsa feel about snow?
People in Tulsa, I think it's a mixed bag. I think some really enjoy it. And then I think some really have this disdain for it. Overall, you know, when it snows in Tulsa, things shut down for the most part. I mean, it shuts down. We do have snow plows here. You know, growing up in Texas, we did not have snow plows, so that was a big thing. But there are snow plows here, so it does allow for people to get out and about. Personally, I like it. We don't get a lot. So when we get a couple of good little snowstorms, you know, with about 6 to 7 inches, which is like a good one for us, it's fun.
6 to 7 inches. We had three storms in January with 6 inches down here, or I should say over and up here in Jersey. But, you know, it's all relative. I'll go to Matt, since Kirsten was talking about growing up in Texas. You guys not only grew up in Texas, but went to the same high school of all places. What was it like growing up in San Antonio? Does it even snow there?
It did in 2021, the big winter storm that hit Texas. Not only was it cold, but it was the most snow San Antonio has seen since another storm that hit, I think it was 85. And 85. I was just shocked by the amount of snow that came down. I was in San Antonio in between jobs at the time. And I couldn't believe it, because not only did it snow about 4.5 inches, but if couple days later we got another 2 inches on top of it, and that just blew my mind that you could have one significant snow when you're talking about over 4 inches coming down, and then to have several more inches just a few days later. It was unbelievable, the amount of snow that was on the ground in San Antonio, a place where people usually come during the winter to escape the snow. Not in 2021, and maybe another long time before that happens again. So everybody took lots of pictures and built lots of snowmen.
So you got me thinking, right? Because, like, you know, like we all do, we watch cartoons growing up. So, like, could you just not connect to people who had snow days then growing up? Or you're like, is this like a figment of my imagination, these snow days?
Yeah, the only experience I had growing up, we had ice days where there was a little bit of freezing rain, and so the roads would get icy. But we never had a snow day growing up in Santa. But the kids in 2021, they got a snow day. But of course, it was also kind of a freeze day because of all the power outages and the water going out. So in some ways you couldn't enjoy the snow as much because of all of that. So if we had just gotten the snow, it would have been okay and kind of skipped the actual really cold part, but it probably wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been that cold. So, you know, just good and bad.
Well, Matt, you're certainly getting more snow now being in Chicagoland. So it's a different story. And let me bring it back on over to the, we'll say the mid-Atlantic, northeastern ish area, but Sean over at the, Richmond Times this past. Sean, I mean, you lived in PA, you lived in Virginia. You know what snow's like.
Yeah, we do know what the snow is like, but it is a different response, to be sure, in Virginia versus Pennsylvania. And even depending on what part of Pennsylvania you're in, for that matter. But, you know, Virginia is where I'm concentrated now, and things shut down. They just do. There are snow plows. There is salt to remove snow removing equipment, but you know, it's just not something that we deal with frequently enough to be good at dealing with it. You know, we had a couple of very small events last year, a couple inches here or there, but that was about it. I mean, I do kind of look forward to this, to an 8 to 10 inch blanket over across an entire city that really just kind of quiets everything down for a few days. But one of the things that in my advanced age is that I don't like it sticking around. I love a good 8 or 10 inch snow, but then I want it to melt in 2 days and just be gone and be done. I don't want to deal with the mud. I don't want to look at dirty snow that's been sitting around for 4 or 5 days, plowed up on the sides of the road. I just don't want any part of that. So I love the snow while it's fresh, but when it's done, you got 24 hours. And then let's move on.
Well, I think Virginia is probably pretty good for you then. You're a little further south, sun melts it a little bit faster.
Now, the other thing that really I get more concerned about than anything else is ice immediately eastward from the Appalachians here, anywhere from, you know, out in our western counties toward Lynchburg, Charlottesville. I mean, we get the cold air damming situations here a lot in Virginia. So one of the biggest headaches we have is what we like to call P-type, precipitation type, where some places get rain, some places get ice, some places get snow. And that's really the biggest headache that when it comes to forecasting winter in Virginia.
I feel like, Sean, you and I are similar in the sense that our average snow is low enough where one or two snow events can get you right up to average quickly. It's a little different in Chicago or where our friend Judah Cohen is over in the Boston area. We'll bring him in here. He is somewhat of a Twitter celebrity. You can follow him at Judah47 on Twitter. He's infamous for his snow sweater that he's going to be hopefully dusting out as we go into December for this snow lover over here. But Judah, thanks for being on the show. We appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You know, growing up, you grew up in Brooklyn, New York, correct? And then moved to Massachusetts, right?
Right. Yeah, I grew up in Brooklyn. Let's call it the Florida of New York City, where I was right there on the water.
What part of Brooklyn's the Florida of New York City? Is that the Rockaways?
Sheepshead Bay.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Anybody likes fishing, maybe, you know, you've gone there to catch a boat to go fishing. And I spent a lot of time in school in Manhattan, so upper West Side.
Right. Yeah. You were at Columbia,
15 years as a student. So I think it's a record. And they finally pushed me out the door, and then I headed north. I was right after the winter of 95, 96. I figured this was as good as it gets. I got to go further north if I want to see some more snow. And that still remains New York City's snowiest winter. So it was a good choice.
Man, you were good. Now, speaking of snowiest winter, and we'll dive into your career in a little bit, but you were in Boston for the infamous winter of 2014-15. And, you know, Sean was talking about snow that turns into mud. Weren't they still seeing snow until like June in a snow pile somewhere in Boston?
Yeah, snow lasted till July.
Actually. July, excuse me.
Yeah, in a snow pile there with a lot of rubbish.
Yeah, a lot of rubbish. I think people were skiing down that big patch of ice at some point, weren't they?
Yeah, so I actually like to say, you know, a lot of times on Twitter, people are like, oh, you know, it doesn't snow as much as it used to when I was a kid. You know, we had so much more snow, but I actually, the data says we're in the golden age of nor'easters for the northeastern U.S. So, you know, Boston just recently had its snowiest decade on record, New York City as well. I don't know how far south that goes, but it's been great since I moved up here. I feel very fortunate. I love snow, and I definitely feel like I've experienced, you know, some really nice snowstorms, including, you know, last winter that we shared there with Atlantic City. But
we did share. I think, you know, relatively speaking, I think we won out on that one. I was very happy with our record snowy January here. But tell us, what got you interested into weather? Was it snow that got you interested?
Yeah, it was snow. I love snow. You know, I was always looking forward to you start off with the snow days, you know, the snow and the snow days, and always would listen to the forecasts, you know, trying to, you know, anticipate when the next snowstorm would come. And, and from snow, I guess I just got gained this general interest in the weather. I did a term paper, as I said, back in the day, I don't know what they call them now, on weather. I got an A+, and that was it. I was hooked. Figured this is it. This is what I was destined to do. And yeah, I feel very fortunate to have been able to, you know, really make a career of it.
Hey, Judah, Sean down in Richmond, were there any one or two storms that really kind of hooked you, or was it just one of these things that ever since you were little or as far back as you can remember, you just like snow? I mean, growing up in the 70s in Richmond, I remember a few big snowstorms, a few big nor'easters that, you know, actually made the top 50 list there from Uccellini. And the Coast and Uccellini book.
Yeah.
So I remember some of those very well. But were there any specific storms that were very formative for you?
Yeah. So, you know, so in the 70s, when I was growing up as well, I guess those very early formative years, There wasn't a lot of snow in Brooklyn, certainly New York City, but and I remember even before getting any big ones, really looking forward to snow. We had a big ice storm, I think, in like December 1973. Very interesting. Over an inch of ice accumulated on the trees. It was beautiful. I mean, it was very not a good situation, but it was incredibly beautiful. But I say this one storm that really solidified for me was, February 1978. So I was in Brooklyn, I think February 78 is most famous for its impact in eastern New England, where they had, I think Rhode Island somewhere, recorded like over 50 inches. And I think they had certainly hurricane force winds, maybe even over 100, and some big flooding. But in Brooklyn, it was certainly the biggest storm I'd ever experienced, about 2 feet of snow at my house. And, just the way it transformed the landscape to me, it was just really magical. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about how it gets ugly, so in an urban area, it gets ugly quickly. But at least those first 24 hours, when it's so pristine and white, it's really, just really transforms that urban landscape. To me, it makes it beautiful. Maybe other people see it just as a nuisance, but for me, it's just really magical. We got a whole bunch of snow days in there too.
Hey, Judah, it's Matt. Yeah, there are a lot of strong opinions when it comes to snow. I mean, I've meteorologist in Virginia, in Richmond, in Cincinnati, in the Rio Grande Valley, and the reactions you get to snow vary so much. Even in one place, there are people that love snow and can't get enough of it, and there's some people that absolutely want no bit of it. So this is the time of year where those opinions start to come out and people start to wonder what's going to happen. What is this winter going to be like? And the snow lovers get excited. Please tell me there's going to be a lot of snow. And the people who hate snow say, please let it be as warm a winter as possible. So this is the time of year where people start focusing on what is the winter going to be like. And for you, when it comes to making a seasonal forecast and forecasting what winter is going to be like, what are the things that you are looking at when you make that seasonal forecast? And what is winter going to be like? What are the things that go into your seasonal forecast?
And so, we include in our winter forecast the one thing that everybody looks at, which is the El Nino Southern Oscillation. So that's the equatorial Pacific sea surface temperatures, especially in the eastern equatorial Pacific, off the coast of South America. So when it's warm, it's El Nino. When it's cold, it's La Nina. And we have a rare three-peat La Nina this year. So the waters are actually cold in that part of the ocean. So we look at that, but I really try to focus on things what people have kind of not looked at or ignored, or I don't know what the right term might be, but looking at Arctic predictors. Traditionally in making these climate forecasts, people always thought you needed to really focus on the tropics, that the tropics has kind of the size and the heat, like the energy, to really make a difference, where the Arctic is low energy relatively small. The first thing I think what I'm probably best known for is looking at snow cover extent across Eurasia or Siberia in the fall months, but I've really focused in on October. And so I look at that. So it turns out if there's more snow in Siberia in the month of October, we tend to get here in the eastern U.S. colder and snowier winters. It's hard to make a snowfall forecast, especially in cities that have marginal amount of snow, because one big snowstorm can make or break a whole season. But I've tried it. It's actually a fairly decent relationship between Siberian snow cover in the fall or in October and snowfall in the big northeastern cities. I haven't tried Tulsa, but certainly, DC, Boston, New York City. So when there's more snow cover, not depth, we tend to get more snowfall. So that's one predict. Yeah, that's been the predictor I've used the longest. And I've tried to incorporate more recently looking at Arctic sea ice. It's the opposite relationship with Arctic sea ice as it was snow cover. More snow, colder winter, less snow, milder winter. The less sea ice, a colder winter, more sea ice, a milder winter. That might be a little bit counterintuitive, but that's how the relationship seems to be working out. And with climate change, the sea ice now is, it's always below normal. So, but it depends where the sea ice forms regionally. So if it's on the North Atlantic side towards like Scandinavia, Urals, which is, northwestern Russia, that's most favorable for kind of impacting the whole, circulation pattern across the Northern Hemisphere. We could talk about the polar vortex, because really all my work goes through the polar vortex one way or another. And if there's more, if the bigger sea ice anomalies or, you know, departures from normal occur more on the North Pacific side, that tends to favor a stronger polar vortex. I won't say necessarily a milder winter, because there's some research that says that that does favor colder winters in the eastern U.S., but it does, you know, make for a stronger polar vortex. So also, I talked about the trends in sea ice. I also want to talk about the trends in snow cover, because it's been very interesting. Certainly with climate change, a warmer world, you'd expect there to be less snow. But the but in the fall, especially, you know, when the temperatures are rather marginal to support snow, so like in the fall months. But Siberia has actually been seeing an increasing trend over the past, you know, 2-3 decades easily, you know, which is interesting, because if I'm, you know, I'm the argument I'm making is, you know, the more snow, the colder the winters. You would certainly expect that Siberian snow cover to have been dwindling or, you know, kind of disappearing, and it should be kind of compounding maybe, you know, the mild winter, you know, mild winters here. But that's not been the case. And it's certainly gone contrary to what their expectation and projections were. So, but I, you know, again, I think overall we've had a surprising, you know, kind of robust winters in the U.S., especially after New Year's. You know, December has been quite a mild month overall. Yeah, and I've tried, as part of the explanation, I try to give why, you know, how come people can talk about, you know, you started off here talking about, like, you know, you said 2021 was your biggest snowstorm, you know, memory of a snowstorm in Texas. You know, why isn't he, you know, have to go back to the 1880s? And I talked about, you know, we talked about 2015 here in Boston, or even 2010. For the DC mid-Atlantic area, you know, why is it that we could talk about these really big snowstorm or snowy winters, and a lot of them are very recent, you know, not, you don't have to go back 50, 60, you know, 70 years to try to recall one. And part of the answer I give, you know, that I try to propose is that this surprising increasing trend in the Siberian snow cover in the fall months.
Gino, we talked briefly about you know, your Twitter account and how big you are on the social media world, and so I wanted to touch on that just a little bit too. I'm sure you see a lot of hype out there, you know, these predictions where people just kind of blow things up. What would you say is your biggest worry with that, and then how, as a professional, would you try to combat that hype?
Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, exactly what you're referring to, but I, you know, I'll start off, and you can try to veer me in the right direction. And certainly when I made this a career, I didn't think the Farmer's Almanac would be my biggest competitor, you know, but that seems to get a lot of attention, you know, and even on the news. And as far as I can tell, there's no real science behind it. And, you know, they always seem to come out with a cold, snowy winter. And, you know, and people say, oh, I heard it's going to be a really bad winter. And, you know, I have to say, you know, and they tell, oh, I heard on the Farmer's Almanac. I had to kind of temper their expectations there, that, you know, I wouldn't put too much stock with the Farmer Almanac. But I think a lot of people, you know, if you're going to predict a cold, snowy winter, I don't know too much about other people's forecasts. I don't try to pay too much, that much attention. I want to kind of don't want to be influenced by what other people are saying or thinking. But I think if you want to get attention, you know, if you say mild and no snow, no one's really going to give you attention. So I think it's a bit of a tension seeker to try to, you know, play it up to be as bad as, you know, the worst possible scenario. But you know, I mean, the Weather Service, the National Weather Service, I think they're very conservative. I mean, you know, they're almost to the other extreme, you know, very little hype. You know, they really focus on, like I started speaking about, you know, ENSO, El Nino Southern Oscillation. They really are very hesitant to kind of, that's their comfort zone, and they don't want to seem to get out of that comfort zone. I mean, I certainly try to push, you know, trying to anticipate what's going on with the polar vortex. I really haven't spoken about that too much yet, but you know, they won't go there. You know, I think their attitude is, well, we can't, you know, yes, it's important, but we can't predict this behavior. So we're not going to even try or even discuss it in their winter outlooks. I think that's really important. I mean, again, the science is not as, doesn't have as long a history talking about the influence of the polar vortex in our winter weather as much as tropical forcings, especially, you know, the El Nino Southern Oscillation phenomena. But I think, you know, if you really want to get the forecast right here in the U.S., you know, you really have to try to anticipate how the polar vortex will behave in the winter months.
Judah, let's talk about the polar vortex a little bit more here. There's two different kinds of polar vortex events, right? We have the split and then we have the stretch. Can we talk a little more in detail on what those mean and what they can do for portions of the United States?
So I'm just going to modify a little bit what you said. So I think traditionally people think of the polar vortex being in two states. There's a strong state where this polar vortex is very stable, and then there's a weakened state where it takes two forms. It takes either, it can split, so it kind of gets pulled, it kind of gets pinched in the middle. So the polar vortex is an area of low pressure. Maybe if I describe it first, then I could talk how it changes. But it's an area of low pressure that sits right over the North Pole. It's high up in the atmosphere. So it's, you know, if you think of the atmosphere having two layers, we and Liv and the, all the weather occurs in the troposphere. And then above that, starting about like 5 miles up in the sky, especially in the higher latitudes, you get into the stratosphere, and that's where the polar vortex resides. So just like all storm systems, the circulation has a circulation that circulates around that low pressure center, and again, it goes counterclockwise, which is always how it goes in the northern hemisphere. And it's when it's in a strong, stable state, I like to give the analogy of like a spinning top. So it's spinning in its normal state, it's strong and stable. So it's like that, very fast, quiet rotation with a spinning top. It kind of sits in place, and just spins and keeps all the air, so it's over the Arctic. So it's really the coldest air in the hemisphere. It keeps it very close, close to that rotation. And we're here where we are further south in the mid latitudes, not over the Arctic, tends to be milder. And then the others, but sometimes the polar vortex gets weakened or disrupted. And again, traditionally, it was thought there were two types of disruptions. There was a polar vortex displacement. So if you think about, if you had that nice fast spinning top and it hits something, or you throw something in its way and it bangs into it, it'll start wobbling and meandering. And so that's how it will happen with the polar vortex. It will kind of meander off the North Pole and go somewhere else. That's called a displacement, because the polar vortex stays, integral, it stays one piece, but it gets bodily moved to another location, typically towards Eurasia or towards North America. And the other big disruption is where it gets pinched off, in the middle, and it gets pulled apart, and it splits into two pieces, and they're called daughter vortex. You have a parent vortex when it's one, and then it splits into these daughter vortices, two. And that's what all people really, in the literature, that was like 99.9% of the papers are talking about this binary behavior of the polar vortex, either strong and stable or weak, where it either displaces or splits. Now, I've been involved with colleagues. We've kind of been pushing this other behavior of the polar vortex seemed to get like no attention. It was not kind of ignored or just wasn't fully appreciated, where similar to like a split, it gets pulled. Like, so if you think of it like taffy, it gets kind of stretched. Traditionally it was called something else, but I like to call it, you see it get stretched or elongated. And again, if you think of the circulation around the polar vortex as kind of the southward boundary of the really cold air in the northern hemisphere, if it's nice and circular, right? So that boundary is very far north, and the cold air stays over the Arctic. But if you start pulling it apart, right, so and the cold air is inside of that circulation, that cold air can expand or extend much further south. So when you get the stretching of the polar vortex and, extends into the United States, let's say, that's when you have these cold air outbreaks. And, I have a couple of papers on different winters where this happened, but one of them was this February 2021, Texas freeze, which was so impactful. There were these larger disruptions in January it displaced and split a little bit. They're all grouped as a sun-stratospheric warming. They're called that because this warm air rushes into the Arctic region. You get these very dramatic warmings of the polar stratosphere. So, the Arctic region and the stratosphere, like you can go up 100 degrees Fahrenheit in a few days or something, like something that would never happen at the surface. So that's why it's called the names, hence sun-stratospheric warming. So there was one in January. So when we had the Texas freeze, everybody, like the whole community said, oh, it's related to this very large disruption, in January. But that we wrote this paper, some colleagues saying, no, there was actually the stretching of the vortex that happened in February that kind of just got missed and ignored. And that was really what was most responsible for that Texas freeze.
All right. Well, awesome stuff so far, Judah. We're going to have our astronomy break with Tony Rice. On the other side, we have more questions for Judah Cohen, Director of Seasonal Forecasting at AER on the Across the Sky podcast.
Looking beyond the atmosphere, here's Tony Rice with your astronomy outlook.
Tuesday, November 8th is Election Day here in the U.S. There will also be a total lunar eclipse that morning, the 2nd of 2002. Partial eclipse begins at 4:09 a.m. Eastern, that Tuesday morning, as the moon begins its journey through the umbra, or the darkest part of the Earth's shadow. It slips completely into that shadow, turning a deep orange at 5:16 a.m. Eastern. It begins to emerge about an hour and 25 minutes later. The point of greatest eclipse, when the moon will be at its deepest red color, will be just before 6 a.m. Eastern. Unlike solar eclipses, which vary in timing depending on where you are, lunar eclipses are identical, once you adjust for the time zones, of course, wherever you are. As long as the moon is above the horizon for you, you can see the eclipse. Here on the East Coast, the moon will have set before that partial eclipse phase ends at 7:49 a.m. The farther west you go, the more of a complete show you'll see. You might have seen this one described as the first eclipse on an election day, and that got me breaking out my slide rule and a few history books for a little fact-checking. Yes, this is indeed the first time a total lunar eclipse has been visible from the United States on the first Tuesday following the first Monday in November, and that's not going to happen again until 2506. But there have been a lot of lunar eclipses on days when Americans have gone to the polls. Just most of them weren't visible from the U.S., or the U.S. at the time. Election Day as we know it wasn't a thing until 1845, when Congress enacted the Presidential Election Day Act. According to Evan Andrews at the History Channel, before then, states held their elections any time they pleased within a 34-day period before the first Wednesday in December. A total lunar eclipse was visible around moonrise on the evening of November 24th, 1844, across the then 26 United States. But that was a Sunday, so it's pretty safe to say the polls were closed. So for total lunar eclipses, you've got to go a bit further back, to November 3rd, 1808, a Thursday, when James Madison was on his way to being elected the fourth president. For a bit of the math behind this, check out github.com/rtphokey/election-day-eclipses. That's your astronomy outlook. Follow me at rtphokey for more spacey stuff like this.
Shout out to Tony for the astronomy report. As always, Sean, you had a question for Judah.
Your company AER, just for the audience, what does AER and what is it that y'all do there?
First of all, it's not my company. I work for them. I'm an employee. So make everybody clear.
Got it.
Sometimes people think that I own AER. I don't. AER stands for Atmospheric Environmental Research. So they're a private company, but most of the revenue comes from government grants. So NASA and NOAA have traditionally been the biggest funders for AER. People see those really nice satellites of hurricanes or, the weather, storms. Those are, the GOES satellites. So AER has played a big part in those. More recently was the GOES-R. I think like the next generation is going up soon. That's not really what I do. So most of my funding actually comes from the National Science Foundation, which is, funds basic research. And I've been fortunate enough, they've given me money to kind of look at climate variability. So, how does the climate system work? And certainly I've tried to use that new understanding of the climate variability to make better climate predictions. So I work in the subseasonal to seasonal space. So beyond 2 weeks, so the weather models go up to 2 weeks. That's, we're talking about short-term weather, synoptic, people know, but I'm beyond that. So the weather models kind of lose their ability to make accurate forecasts. Yeah, so that's kind of the wild, wild west for a forecast thing. Yeah, like the Holy Grail, I think, is that 2 to 6 week window. That's where, interestingly enough, it's the forecasts are at their poorest. So they're very good in the short term, and there's some improved accuracy when you do very long term, like 3 months. But in between, less than that, for some reason, that's the worst, accuracy of all these forecasts. So I've been focusing in that area, and I've been very thankful that the National Science Foundation has been a very good supporter of mine. And so besides doing the basic research, we also put out forecasts, and I have a blog. So, so Joe was very nice to, give me a shout out on Twitter, but I do have a blog that's, once a week. And I think people are most interested in the winter. That's what I'm best known for. And if they just, it's a long link. So URL, I don't even remember what the whole thing is, but just, you know, search Judah Cullen blog or Judah Cullen Arctic. Sure, will be the first thing that pops up.
Or you can follow you on Twitter at Judah47.
And I always let people know when the blog is up and available to read. So yeah, I mean, from Twitter, they can, I mean, if they're looking at me, you know, consistently, they'll see my tweet about the blog. But if not, it's it goes public Wednesday at 3 p.m. every week in the winter months. Welcome anybody to check it out and, you know, try to anticipate, you know, what's going to happen beyond what, you know, what the weather, you know, the forecast centers, the government forecast centers are saying.
And Judah, this is the time of year where lots of seasonal forecasts, winter forecasts are coming out. And I think a couple that get the most buzz are the ones from the Farmer's Almanac, which gets confusing because there actually are two Farmer's Almanacs. There's the Farmer's Almanac and then the Old Farmer's Almanac. And they do publish separate forecasts. Sometimes they're very similar, sometimes they're different. And I think maybe what gets the buzz there is they keep it very simple and kind of very vague. And they use very strong words like bone chilling cold and incredible amounts of snow. They use very dramatic language. And I think that gets lots of buzz on social media. And it really has, I mean, they have been around for hundreds of years to their credit. They started before we have the science and the knowledge that we do now. And they seem to stick to these formulas that they don't really reveal. You kind of go on their websites and they give a little bit of detail, but not too much detail. And they talk about, well, only a few people know the secret formula. And he goes by the name Caleb Weatherby. I know that's the Farmer's Almanac. And it's like, why is he hiding who he is? If he really is a great forecaster, wouldn't he be like you and come on the podcast and talk about how he makes his forecast? And somehow doesn't happen. But just in your opinion, what's your opinion of the Farmer's Almanac forecast?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, really know too much. I made, you know, previous segment, I made a crack out. I never didn't realize they'd be my biggest competitor. But I mean, like, you know, again, it's a black box, you know, it's all the web proprietary. So I think that it's hard to judge what they're using if you don't know what it is. And again, yeah, I agree with you. I think they keep the forecast very vague. So almost no matter what happens, you know, if it snows once, oh yeah, we got it right. We said it was going to snow. We said it was going to be cold. You know, so we were right. But I think of it, it should really be thought of as entertainment, not really rigorous science. But I feel like people give it a lot of credence, you know, more credence or credibility than it deserves. But to be fair, I don't know what goes in it. I think they're like lunar and solar cycles or something like that in there that they don't tell you. Obviously, you know, they really predated modern meteorology. So I don't, you know, they use a woolly caterpillar or the, you know, how bushy the squirrel tail is. I don't know, but I think people should see it more entertainment than really credible science. But hopefully it'll come after me. But I'm sure, you know, I'm sure they hear a lot. So, and, you know, and they've done fine with, you know, without my, giving them an endorsement. So,
yeah, the thing we heard a lot about here in Tulsa this year, for whatever reason, this is kind of going back to like the hype that I was talking to you about on Twitter, was the persimmon forecast, which I guess has been around for a long time. Honestly, I've never heard of it prior to like the past couple of years.
It's the first time I'm hearing it myself. I've never heard of it.
It goes along the same line as the woolly caterpillar or the bushy, you know, squirrel tail. It's, you take a persimmon, you slice the seed in half, and then it shows a little, either a little shovel, a fork, or a knife. You know, you have a black and white kind of design inside, and it's always one. But apparently this year it's the shovel, so it means it's going to be a very snowy forecast. So I had questions about that in Tulsa. And but, you know, again, it kind of goes back to just that, the entertainment, I think that you just mentioned, you know, kind of like the groundhog, right? It's just kind of the
entertainment. Yeah. I mean, sure. I mean, the groundhog gets a lot of attention. I don't even know how that works. How does not ever see a shadow? I mean, always to see a shadow. They have those big, you know, TV camera lights on him or her. I don't know what gender the groundhog is, and they're obviously different groundhogs. But
so, Judah, I wanted to ask, kind of going back to you know, the forecasting and the research that you're doing right now, you know, what a lot of changes, of course, have happened over the years as far as tools. What do you say? What would you say are the biggest changes that you've seen in forecasting tools, and how has that helped you predict the future, you know, winter forecasts here in the most recent years?
Again, when I started my career in late 1990s, I mean, it was all ENSO all the time. It was really the trot, like to even just mention or, even to entertain the idea of using something other than the Trobix to make a long range forecast was considered, like the Farmer's Almanac, pseudoscience. So, again, I've been pushing using R2 predictors and other people have been looking at it. I think that is, so again, when I used to go to these conferences, every session was on ENSO. you cannot even consider anything else. So I'm glad that, we've kind of become, included other ideas, more varied than just all ENSO all the time. Again, we use dynamical models. All meteorologists know we go to the model. So, we just came out of the hurricane season, right? And again, Ian, there was this controversy because the American model predicted, further west, and European was better getting the track. And that led to a delay of the evacuation of the hardest hit area. So hopefully people, I'm just trying to give an idea, maybe people hear about the models. So that's used for the longer range forecasts. And, they're good, but they have their limits. And I've been more recently trying to use, so I've always used statistical techniques to try to make and improve on the forecast. So kind of complement the dynamical, these numerical weather prediction models. I don't know how people might think of them, but they solve the equations of physics explicitly. But I try to use statistical models, and more recent past few years, I've been introducing machine learning, and I'm excited by the prospects of how machine learning could, help, improve the forecast. So, I say for me, the pig too, and I'm speaking from my own perspective, my own opinion, but kind of looking outside of the tropics, in particular, higher latitudes, Arctic, so snow and ice, not just the sea surface temperatures, and also these machine learning techniques to kind of supplement or complement these, dynamical models that are solving equations of, motion of the atmosphere explicitly. Now, recently, again, I'm not so much involved. I don't know if people hear the term Madden-Julian oscillation. That's kind of a wave that goes across the tropics that circumnavigates the globe close to the equator. I mean, that's been an area of a lot of research recently. I haven't really participated so much in that. But that's a recent phenomenon that people, feel. And I agree. I mean, it's good for short term, like a few weeks, not can't be used for a seasonal forecast, but it certainly can be maybe a 2 or 3 week forecast. I do think there's information there that can be exploited to improve on the forecast, but I'm not so much involved with that.
Got it. Well, thanks so much, Judah, for the time so far. Like we said, this is just part one of two of our winter forecast preview here. We talked in this first segment a lot about Judah. We talked about his work and his research. But if you come back next Monday, we're going to get into the meat and potatoes of what Judah believes can happen here across the United States as we go into the winter of 2022 and 2023. So we will see you all next week here for the second part of this Across the Sky podcast.